Your job is to tell the truth. That's your job as a journalist. And if you can't do that, you're in the wrong job.
That it wasn't my job, that it isn't our job to be popular.
It was interesting to me how they fit together as a book. I mean, I'm not nearly smart enough to have done that on purpose.
When Lance went on Oprah Winfrey and admitted being a drugs cheat, the Sunday Times said, thank you very much, we are now counter-suing you.
Welcome all, it is episode 72 of Behind the Lines, here on The 42 with me, Gavin Cooney. This week's guest is football writer Michael Cox. Michael rose to prominence with his blog Zonal Marking, which broke new ground with its focus on football tactics. From there, Michael wrote for The Guardian and ESPN, became a regular contributor to The Guardian's Football Weekly, and he is now a staff writer at The Athletic and is a regular contributor to the Totally Football Show podcast. He has written two books, The Mixer, which is a history of tactics in the Premier League, and Zonal Marking, the making of modern European football. So let's get to the conversation with Michael Cox. Michael Cox, thanks so much for doing the show.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
So we obviously have to start with the Super League, I think, because it is it's arguably the most amazing story just in terms of sheer drama and obviously potential ramifications that we've had in football in quite a while. You had an excellent piece on The Athletic on Monday. It was titled Europe's Leagues Are Broken, a Super League Might Be the Only Solution. Can you maybe take us through your argument in that piece just to start off?
Yeah, I mean, I was keen to say that I didn't in any way support the iteration of the Super League that was being proposed for three reasons. One, I don't think you can cherry pick sides based upon revenue rather than sporting competition. Two, you can't exclude promotion and relegation. And three, you can't have those sides playing in this multi-million league and then going back to your domestic leagues. So once you oppose those three things, which are three fundamental things to do with this league, obviously can't support the idea. But I have major concerns really over the lack of competitiveness of the major European leagues as we know them. I think in some forms or in some ways, they've kind of ceased to make sense. I don't really see the value in a 9-month, 380-game Ligue 1 or Serie A when the same team is winning the league 90% of the time. I just think that we're really stretching the boundaries of competitive sport when you look at the nature of some of these leagues. And people say there's always been big sides and small sides, but you look at any measure, whether it's finances or points or goal difference or whatever, the inequalities are huge. My ideal way to try and fix that would be to bring in more revenue sharing and more limits on squad size and maybe wage caps and financial solutions. But if that is impossible, and I have my doubts, then I think you need sporting solutions. And I think the point of leagues is basically to group teams together that are relatively well matched and can compete in a reasonably evenly balanced league. And I don't think we have that anymore. Premier League maybe more so than the other ones. But I think there's a real issue with competitiveness over the across the continent. And I think some form of European league in the future may be viable, but certainly not the one that was proposed this week.
That was written in the ancient age of Monday when this thing looked like it might happen. It's now since collapsed. The way you describe it there, I wouldn't be too optimistic that the inequalities that you describe in domestic leagues and arguably that are manifesting themselves in the Champions League now as well are ever really going to be tackled.
Yeah, I'm skeptical. I mean, God knows what's going to happen. There are some people more positive than me who think that after the wave of what happened yesterday, I suppose, as we're talking now, so Monday night at Chelsea in particular, that the fans will feel empowered and there will be a shift away from, you know, the situation at the moment. But personally struggling to see a path to that, I must say. And I think really, I mean, if you kind of take away the nonsense of Sunday to Tuesday, basically, wasn't it, where we had this Super League idea. What has happened in the last few days is that UEFA have waved through the proposals that we should be horrified by. The idea that, you know, the sides who don't qualify for the Champions League will still get in there based upon coefficient places. I mean, that's the worst reform that's ever happened to the Champions League. So, and there's now a suggestion, I saw Martin Ziegler, who I think broke the initial story, has now suggested that there's a movement to kind of do away with these coefficient places, as they're being called. If that happens, then I think we can call the last few days a success. But if that doesn't happen, I'm struggling really to see that we should be dancing on the streets about this. Fantastic that this the Super League plan as it was killed, but actually I still think Europe is in quite a bad position in terms of the competitiveness of the domestic leagues and also of the Champions League.
Did you at least enjoy the drama of the last 48 hours?
To a certain extent, I must admit, I was at the pub yesterday and just with one friend and was desperately trying not to check my phone and work out what was happening. But yeah, I missed all the drama of last night. A strange few days. A lot of people at, within Football Journalism were a lot busier than me. You know, it's not really, I'm not really a digger or a reporter or an investigator. So yeah, I was relatively out of it.
Yeah. So let's talk about you for a couple of minutes, Michael. It's pretty widely known, I think, that you rose to prominence through your blog, Zonal Marking. Just to talk about it briefly, why did you start it and when did you start it?
I started at the start of 2010. I'd written a few articles for some other blogs, which I carried over onto the site. But yeah, the website launched at the start of 2010. From my perspective, I wanted to get into journalism. I wanted to be a football journalist. I wanted to do things a little bit differently. I wanted to talk about the tactics and the strategies, and I wanted to break down games. I was always surprised there wasn't more of that in newspapers. I mean, there was to a certain extent on television, and I think newspaper coverage of other sports was often a little bit more advanced. Particularly cricket has always been based around statistics and analysis. And that the idea really was just to get my name out there, I suppose, and try to get a job or try to get work on the back of this. So it felt like a kind of untapped niche, that, you know, a gap in the market. But I don't mean that in a business sense. I mean, obviously the site itself has never made money, you know, I would never have earned more than minimum wage from doing that. But certainly in terms of my profile, I suppose, as a, you know, 21, 22-year-old journalist with no real experience and no real contacts, it seemed the best way to get my name out there.
And were you always fascinated by football tactics, or was it a slightly more pragmatic decision that, look, this isn't being written about anywhere, I'll be the guy to do this?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose by the standards of journalism around at the time, I was certainly interested in football tactics more than most people. But what I discovered, and not just me, but of course, you know, Jonathan Wilson had been writing about tactics before I had done. It seemed there was a bit of a, movement's the wrong word, but there was a group of people who were far more interested in that side of the game than they were getting from newspapers or television or radio coverage. So yeah, it was something I was interested in. But I mean, if I was getting into football journalism now, or even 5 years ago, when there was, of course, a lot of tactical analysis on the internet, far more so than a decade ago, whether I would go down that route, I think is questionable. It, you know, to a certain extent, it was about doing something that people were not doing.
You mentioned Jonathan Wilson, Inverting the Pyramid, his book about the history of football tactics, was one of your picks. At risk of asking an obvious question, why did you pick it?
Yeah, it was a bit of a game changer for me, and I think for a lot of people. It came out, I think, in 2008, and I could be wrong, but I think at the time it wasn't as big as it became maybe 5 or 6 years later. It felt like it was the more everyone who read it recommended it to people, and it kind of seemed to grow organically into it. Yeah, I mean, I would say it's not just a great history of tactics. I think it's a great history of football. And it's the first book I read that really explained in depth why that Hungary side were great in the 1950s and why the Brazilian side of the 1970s was great and so on. So it explored a lot more than football tactics, but it did so from a position of football tactics. And yeah, it was a book that showed that people were receptive to that kind of writing about football. So yeah, from my perspective, it was a game changer, and I don't know whether I'd be doing what I am doing now were it not for the inspiration of that book, and also Jonathan's columns for The Guardian, which he was writing at the same time about football tactics, which were, you know, a bit more about topical issues. But yeah, it was, I think, a really big step forward for football journalism.
Yeah, and it's now been embraced by football journalism. Your work, Jonathan's work, and the work of so many others, I mean, particularly at The Athletic, where you write now, things have changed a lot in the space of 10 years in terms of how we talk about football in the media.
Yeah, it has. I mean, I think there's still a, there's probably still two camps, and, you know, almost the debate has shifted. Maybe 6 or 7 years ago, people thought maybe there was too much writing about tactics. In the last couple of years, there's often been debates about XG and the statistical side of things. But yeah, I mean, things have moved on a lot. I think the key has been the industry is no longer completely dominated by newspapers and traditional media outlets. It's very easy for anyone to set up a blog or a podcast or a YouTube channel. And therefore, I think whatever niche you have or whatever niche you're interested in, there's content out there for you. But yeah, certainly the mainstream has incorporated more things that I think a few years ago would have been considered kind of specific or kind of new to the genre. But you can, I mean, you can read the Times and they talk about XG, which, you know, to me feels like quite a big thing. And in 2 or 3 years, I'm sure it will shift towards other things.
Do you look at XG in the Times and reflect with a tiny bit of pride?
Not personally, but, you know, there's a few people in particular who work for Opta who were really big in pushing that. And I mean, it's been on Match of the Day, I think, for three seasons, I think. So it's kind of broken through into the mainstream, and I think is the best. Again, I think it's a bit of a game changer in being a statistical measure that is relatively easily understood if you are interested in understanding it. I think it's easy to dismiss it out of hand. And it does work. I mean, it's a better predictor of future football performance than goals or than any other stats. So it is worthwhile paying attention to if you're interested in that kind of thing. And I think I think journalists in general get it and use it well. And I think increasingly the public get it as well.
Mm. Can, just in case there are people listening who don't fully grasp it, could you explain it very quickly?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically a shots figure. I think traditionally everyone's used to kind of, at the end of the game, you see 20 shots to 8 shots or whatever. But we all know a shot from 2 yards isn't the same as a shot from the halfway line. So this basically uses historical information, historical data about shots and the likelihood of them going in from different positions. And instead of giving 1 to a shot from inside the 6-yard box and 1 to a shot from the halfway line, it will give 0.9 to the former and 0.01 to the latter. And you add them up and you get a better reflection of what happened in the game. And it's not necessarily great for using for individual games, but it's good for long-term trends. You can really look into it and see patterns that are probably of more interest than individual results if you're looking to analyze a team's performance.
Is there a coming stat? Like, I mean, it would have been a bit of a surprise to people that XG appeared on Match of the Day 3 years ago. Is there another coming stat that will soon be incorporated into our Saturday night viewing?
It's a good question. I mean, one of the more interesting things I've seen by an analytics writer called Karen Singh, who is at university, graduated from Cornell University in computer science. He's kind of taken the XG thing, if you like, back a few steps and has come up with a thing called expected threat, which is if you have a ball in a certain part of the pitch, what's the probability that there will be a goal within the next 3 or 4 passes or actions, which has produced some interesting results. And he's got a blog where you can play around with things. And there are a few interesting insights, albeit it's maybe... It's more advanced than XG, but I think that the theory of it makes sense.
I hope they can make more of their expected threats than the breakaway clubs did this week. we have a couple of listener questions, Michael, on this topic. Gavin Riley asks, do you have any theories as to why your model of tactical coverage and analysis is broadly absent from the English press, whereas is much more common on the continent?
It's a good question. I mean, you can probably go back historically and, you know, traditionally there has been almost an anti-intellectualism within English football, which I think Jonathan Wilson, again, has covered very well over the years. I think to a certain extent, it's just a problem with the team as well, in the sense that if you go to any major European country, they have at least one sports newspaper. I think in Spain they have 4, don't they? And they've got to fill 32 pages every day. So you're covering everything. They're covering everything. And I would like to think that, you know, what I've contributed to with The Athletic is kind of along those lines. Whereas I think back in the day, if you just had 5 pages of sport at the back of the Times, every day. You just don't get room to cover those kind of things. And if you are catering for a more general audience, you probably shy away from doing the real specifics. So I think the more there is specific sports media, I think the better the coverage is, basically.
Mm. I was expecting you were going to pick something that featured Pep Guardiola. I didn't expect it to be an article written in 2004, before he was a coach. So this was written by Gabriele Marcotti for the Times when Pep was leaving Barcelona and was on his way to semi-retirement in Qatar. Can you tell us about this piece and why you picked it?
Yeah, I loved it. This, for me, I know it sounds really weird, but this is the only article, aside from some of my own that I have clippings of, that I've ever read and just kept. I actually kept it for a number of years, and I just thought it was a brilliant piece of journalism that, you know, Gab went out to visit Guardiola in Qatar, and Guardiola provides some incredible quotes, basically saying that passing football's dead, his style of midfielder is dead, he was no longer wanted at the top level. And, yeah, it was a rare piece of writing. It was in The Game, which is, you know, the Times football supplement. It was a rare piece of writing that was about the style of the game, about tactics, about long-term shifts, and, of course, was a face-to-face interview with one of my favourite players. I'm not just saying that because he's such a big name, but he was absolutely one of my favourite players. And, of course, at the time, I didn't expect, and I'm sure Gabrielli didn't expect, that Guardiola would be the biggest influence in football over the last 10, 15 years. But yeah, I loved it at the time. I love it even more now because it's the best possible evidence of how much Guardiola has changed. You know, I think it's easy to take for granted the shifts in football over the last decade or so in terms of the emphasis upon possession. And here he is 5 years before he took the Barcelona job when he's almost a nobody saying that that style of football is dead. So yeah, I just think it's a... usually people say an incredible piece of journalism about a real human interest story. But in terms of what I do, in terms of the tactics and stuff, that, yeah, it's probably the key article in my lifetime of following football, never mind writing about it.
Yeah, some of those quotes from Guardiola talking in 2004. If I were a 20-year-old at Barcelona today, I would never make it as a professional. At best, I'd be playing in the third division somewhere. I'm not quick. I never had the stamina to run and run for 90 minutes like central midfielders have to do today. I'm not particularly good in the air. I'm not physically strong. I don't dribble past opponents and I am not a good tackler, but I can pass the ball fairly well. And it's like it is impossible now to read that without knowing the coach that he became, because he effectively, I mean, what a second act, you know, you took early retirement because you're not good enough for the game. So you'll come back and you'll effectively reshape how the game is played, not only in the league that you play in, but arguably right across Europe.
Yeah, remarkable. I mean, particularly because he did it so quickly as well. And I suppose he's kind of moved away from almost being pure Guardiola, pure Barcelona. But obviously that Barca side that had Busquets and Xavi and Iniesta, that was three players who grew up almost being taught to play in the Guardiola style. I think obviously Busquets is the closest comparison. So yeah, I think what he did in a very short period of time between that and, 5 years later, he'd won the European Cup as a manager. Yeah, I think it's brilliant. And I must say, Gabrielli's book, The Italian Job, as well, would be one of my picks if it wasn't for, I didn't want to pick two things by the same author. But again, that was a really good book. I read, I think 2007, 2008, it came out. That was really about football style and the difference in culture between Italian football and English culture. And he wrote it in conjunction with Gianluca Vialli, who was, you know, obviously a very intelligent footballer. And that's a style of book I haven't really seen repeated too much since. One that I really enjoyed.
Has there ever been a coach as influential on Guardiola in terms of how the game is played?
It's a good question. I would say, I mean, it's probably tough to compare with people, you know, really historically, but I would say probably not, in the sense that I think sometimes we overlook the importance of kind of communication technology and the fact that everyone was watching Guardiola's Barcelona and Guardiola's Bayern week in, week out. Coaches all around the world could see that. And if Guardiola was around in the 1970s, that would be so much more difficult for ideas at that point to spread across a country, across a continent, across the world. And so no, I think Guardiola's influence on football is probably greater than anyone let's say in the modern era, you know, probably was different when at the formation of football, but certainly in I would say in the last 70, 80 years, I think he's probably at the top of the tree.
Is it a good thing that everyone could effectively, if not copy him, then be highly, highly influenced by him? Because I love watching the Champions League now at the moment. But, you know, teams generally play in quite a similar way. You know, you don't get from, I don't know, like you'd hear about like Manchester United going away to Juventus in the 1990s and it being a real clash of styles. Sometimes I think there's maybe a slight kind of uniformity of style now in the Champions League, but you can tell me I'm being archaic on this.
No, I completely agree with you. And I know I'm meant to be bigging up other people, but so sorry to plug my own book. But yeah, I mean, you know, the book I wrote, Zonal Marking, is about styles across Europe really over the last 25 or so years. And the conclusion to the book, really, without wanting to give it away, is that, yeah, the styles are less than ever because of, you know, the communication technology, because of the movement of players, the movement of managers, because of the expansion of the Champions League. And yeah, I sometimes watch games. I mean, there was one earlier in the season between Juventus and Barcelona, and I thought exactly what you're saying. They just seemed like two versions of the same style, really, which you would never have said in the 90s when Juventus were tough and tenacious and tactical and not particularly exciting, and Barcelona were all about, you know, a certain style. And, you know, it kind of goes back to what I said at the top in a different way about the idea of a European league. I mean, those two clubs have so much more in common than Juventus do with Torino or Sampdoria or, you know, Valencia on Barcelona's from their perspective. So, yeah, I dare say that is maybe the next iteration of football style. There will be the complete breakdown, if you like, of different styles in different countries, and there'll maybe only be, you know, some concepts like the weather which still impact on how much you can press or something like that. But yeah, the stylistic differences are less than ever. I think that's fair.
Yeah, Conor O'Keefe asks, Michael, I know we're dealing in hypotheticals here, but can you envisage any new major tactical trends in the next decade or so? I know that's linked to what you were saying there.
Yeah, it's always difficult to predict. I mean, my answer for this, because I often get asked it, is it's probably only been two constants over the last 25 years or so. One is the speed of the game has got faster and faster. People, you know, when I was doing research for the books, found, you know, articles in World Soccer magazine in 93 saying the game is just too fast these days. If you go back and watch a game from the 1990s now, it's like you need to watch it on double speed. And the other thing is just the concept of almost universality of players. You know, the defenders need to be the first attackers, the attackers need to be the first defenders. And that concept has always been in football, but it becomes more and more obvious that I think players are very similar to one another. And you see that in new positions all the time. I mean, we've seen João Cancelo for Man City this season is a fullback, but is also a central midfielder as well. And I think to a certain extent, all players now are central midfielders. They are deep central midfielders or they're advanced central midfielders, but the actual qualities you need compared to a footballer from the 1990s, they're pretty much all midfielders, which again goes back to why that Guardiola article was so incredible. Because he's saying that the passing qualities have died out. And now I think passing quality is what you need for every position, even goalkeeper. As much as the specifics, we talk about goalkeepers being good on the ball. He's not the greatest shot stopper, but yeah, I mean, that would be ludicrous to think about 20 years ago, but that does seem the norm now.
Like just the hyper acceleration of the club game and embracing the ideas, I suppose, by Guardiola, and you talk about just how fast it is now. Put the international game up against it for me, and does it look like terribly backward and lacking in sophistication in comparison, in your opinion? I watch Ireland, so I'm no judge of anything here.
Yeah, I didn't see the recent internationals, well, the Ireland one, so I won't go in depth on them. But yeah, I think you're right. I mean, football tactics are so complex these days that I just don't think international sides get enough time to work on the approaches. And I think the successful international sides you see are often ones where there's groups of club players. I mean, who was the last really great European international side? Probably Spain, wasn't it? I mean, and that was broadly a Barcelona side, albeit in a different system. And then you chucked in Ramos and Alonso and Torres at times. I think it's difficult to refute now that the club game is a lot more advanced than the international game. But I must say, I find the international game tactically interesting in other ways. I find it interesting it's not the best football quality, but managers have to come up with interesting solutions to problems, which was why I find it interesting. It's not interesting at a club level where you don't have a good defence, so you can go out and buy two defenders. But at international level, if you don't have a good right back, and you have to solve it by putting a right midfielder there or a left back there or a central midfielder there, then interesting things happen around that. So I think actually the fact your talent pool is limited by definition kind of makes for the, you know, tactical intrigue in one-off games.
I want to talk about England for a minute. I have a take, which you can disabuse me of if you want. If we had, if there was this same sophistication in the media of how we talk about football tactics and approaches as we do now, if we had that 10 years ago, 15 years ago, would Sven's England have won more? Because to my relatively untrained eye, they seemed stacked full of talent and tactically hopeless.
Yeah, I think it's fair. I mean, you know, we always had the debate in English football about whether we should bring in a foreign manager to introduce more continental ideas. And then the two foreign managers we've had, Eriksen and Capello, played 4-4-2 and loved playing Emil Heskey up front. So it's been, it was a strange time. I mean, in terms of specifics with the Sven era, it was like we were caught between two generations in terms of footballers, in terms of tactics. Owen and Beckham were the kind of generation that were around for 1998 who needed a 4-4-2. Beckham needed to be wide right to cross the ball. Owen always had to play as a second striker off a big man. And then you had Gerrard and Lampard, who came through a few years later, who needed a three-man midfield because they needed someone behind them. So, yeah, I completely agree. And, you can go back and you don't even have to watch the games, but you look at the starting 11 for some of the England sides under Sven, and it just looks bizarre, really, like a flat four-man midfield. And even Capello in the 2010 World Cup was not much better in that regard. It was almost like they came over and just thought English players won't be able to cope with anything that isn't 4-4-2, so just played 4-4-2, which maybe defeated the idea of a foreign boss. But then, of course, if you look at their history, they were very much 4-4-2 men. So, yeah, slightly strange situation.
Yeah. What about Gareth Southgate then? How do you rate his tactical chops?
I mean, I like Southgate a lot as a person, and I think he probably doesn't get enough credit for some issues that he's solved so well that they weren't even regarded as issues, if that makes sense. I mean, people forget it, but easing Rooney out was a really important thing to do, and he did it in a way where there was almost no fuss and no backlash, and that was very good. A completely different thing, but there was what I thought was a really difficult situation in the World Cup group where it got to the last game against Belgium, and really England needed to lose that to get the better half of the draw. And I thought he played it brilliantly. I mean, he just masterful handling of the situation. And I think he seems to have a good relationship with the players as well. I think the tactical side is probably the thing that I'm least confident on with him and with the coaching staff in general, because it's never just about the manager. I think that he has struggled to change. He struggled to adapt tactics midway through games. I go back to that Croatia defeat in the semi-final. For me, there was a really simple fix. Every time, Croatia's entire game plan was the two central midfielders would get the ball. They'd play it out to the right back, Vasalico. He was in space because of England's system and playing two up front. And all England needed to do, in my opinion, was either to move one of the forwards out and say, get goal side of Vasalico, or put him wide so that the Croatian right back couldn't attack. I thought that was quite a simple fix. You didn't need to do it on the other side because I think it was Strinic, the Croatian left back, couldn't really cross, couldn't really run. He wasn't a threat. but there was just such an obvious threat, and it had been Croatia's obvious threat in their previous game, maybe their previous two games, and nothing was done about that. And Croatia, I just thought England let the game get away from them by sticking with the same system. And there's been elements of that in other games. The Colombia game, which was the second round, England won the back foot after Peckerman changed. Can't remember what system he changed from into, but he changed from a 3 to a 4 at the back or vice versa. And England didn't adapt to that. So, yeah, as a tactician, it's they're the things I really worry about with England. There are obviously areas of weakness regardless of the system, but I don't think that we're going to win games through tactics.
Yeah, okay. On yourself, like on your own process, if that's the right word, can you generally, if you're like, you know, doing analysis on a particular game for The Athletic the next day, can you generally see the tactical trends straight away, or do you have to rewatch and rewatch?
It's a good question. It's got more difficult, I think, as tactics have got more complex over the last few years. I'd say I spot general patterns first time around, but then have to go through and find specific reasons things happened or specific movements. You know, it's very difficult to take in the movement of 6 or 7 players maybe first time around. So, yeah, and I've almost never completely rewatch a game, but I'll always watch elements of it a second time. But you can usually work out what you need to rewatch, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Have you got a favourite game? Less so in just in terms of sheer enthralling and excitement, but more in terms of, oh, that's tactically fascinating.
In terms of my career as a football journalist, the most interesting one I've covered would be that Barcelona-Inter game at the Nou Camp between Guardiola and Mourinho in 2010, where, you know, everyone was focused on possession play because of Guardiola for the reasons we've mentioned, and Inter went there and Mourinho came out afterwards and said, we didn't want the ball. That I just thought that was the greatest clash of styles you'll ever see. I mean, people forget something. Inter lost that game. Lost the game 1-0. So it wasn't like it wasn't necessarily a Mourinho master plan. But to only lose 1-0 when you were down to 10 men for the majority of the game was obviously what they had to do. But that was, that was an interesting. That seemed to bring together all the elements of what you want really from a tactical battle. Two completely different styles, a very close game or a close tie. And I guess a surprise win is generally more memorable.
I get the feeling that Jose Mourinho never really got over that. You know, that was his high point, and he's been trying to climb that same peak in the last, more than 10 years now.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Gavin. And I think that I wonder how much, I mean, if you look at the first leg, Inter outplayed Barcelona. Inter won 3-1. They outplayed Barcelona. I know there was a thing with the volcano and that to get the bus across to Milan and stuff, but they really outplayed them. And that was a good Inter side. In possession as well. Had some fantastic players. Schneider had his best ever season. And I almost felt Mourinho became, something I covered in the book, but I think he became desperate to be the anti-Barcelona manager. He was almost like his identity was shaped by being the opposite of what Barcelona were. It was actually, when you look at the start of his career, obviously he spent many years at Barcelona as assistant to Van Gaal, and his Porto side were really good footballing side. Dominated possession, I think, in 11 of the 13 matches when they won the Champions League, which is incredible for Porto. I completely agree with you. I think that was both the high point and maybe the thing that caused his decline as well.
Have you got any other coach or manager who you admire a lot from just in terms of what they've done tactically? Obviously, Guardiola's, as discussed, is probably right up there.
Yeah, probably no one that comes close to Guardiola really in terms of his influence or in terms of how much fun I've had looking at the games. I mean, it tends to be managers who have success with one side rather than multiple sides. I think of going back a long way, I really like Walter Mazzarri's Napoli. I think Erik ten Hag's Ajax that got to the semi-finals was doing something really interesting with overloading the opposition on one side. Gasperini with Atalanta, I mean, I haven't seen a system like that before. It's almost like they have two diamonds down the flanks with just a permanent centre back, and they're rotating their position to get around opponents. So I think you tend to see great one-off sides. It's pretty rare for a manager to be really highly successful and tactically interesting across multiple teams, I think. But obviously with Guardiola and Klopp, we do have two around at the moment. Mm. And Conte as well. I must say Conte's sides for me, I know they don't play as good football, but Conte's sides are always really interesting to analyse tactically.
The 30-year picks is Simon Cooper's Football Against the Enemy. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, it's the only book that I've ever bought three times because I lost the first two copies. This came out before I was really of kind of big reading age or football watching age. But I mean, it's just clear from what everyone says about it and going back and reading it that it was a real game changer in the way that football was written about. And again, this is slightly before my time, but I think it came out roughly the same time as Fever Pitch by Nick Hornby, which showed in one sense how football could be written about in a proper way. This was obviously, a completely different style of book. And it was a great example of, I mean, I don't know whether Simon Cooper was writing about football by looking at other things or writing about other things by looking at football, but the combination of using football to explain cultures around the world, I think was probably quite innovative at the time, but now is almost seen as, you know, if you want to write a book about Argentine football, as Jonathan Wilson has, there's as much about other stuff as there is about football. And I think Simon Cooper is obviously a great writer who doesn't just concentrate on football, hasn't concentrated on football for many years, but that probably was a good example of just more intelligent football writing, which is a slightly snobby way of saying it, but I think is also true.
Mm. Michael, we're going to turn for home with a couple of more listener questions. One comes in from former Dundalk manager, Shane Keegan. Michael, the blog was superb. It got to the stage where I was watching games and scribbling down notes to see if my observation would match yours on the blog the next day. And I actually felt that you would have been a good addition to a Premier League backroom team. So would you ever have fancied it?
To be honest, not particularly. I mean, if someone had just said, do you want to be on the coaching staff at Man United, I probably would have said yes, but I mean, it was never like an intention. You know, I must be honest and say that my expectation or my ambition was that I wanted to be a journalist, and that came before the football thing. And if I hadn't written about football, I probably would have written about something else. So I came at it from a journalistic point of view rather than a football point of view. And if I ended up writing about music, then, I wouldn't have thought I could be a producer or whatever. You know, for me, it was. I think I'm a world away from actual coaching. And I think you always have to realise that it's easy to be wise after the event, but whether that translates to being on the dugout or whatever, I don't know. I mean, that maybe there could have been a role in terms of being an analyst for a club, which is, a part of football that has grown significantly over the last few years, but certainly wasn't any particular ambition.
Mm. Phil asks, Michael is one of the first football journalists to rise to real prominence, initially through a blog as opposed to the traditional print route. Do you feel like you A, missed out on anything by not having that grounding, and B, do you get treated differently by those with a more, quote, traditional background?
That's a good question. Really good question. The first part, I would say, I think, yes, I did. I think I did miss out on certain elements of that. I mean, in 10 years as a journalist, I've never broken a story. I've very rarely done any real journalism in the true sense of a journalism. And I think, when I talk to my editors at The Athletic, what they want from up-and-coming journalists is not really someone who can write about tactics. It's someone who's a real journalist who goes out there and gets stories. And I think now there's so many people writing about tactics, what has separated good young journalists is the ones who can go out there and get stories. And to a certain extent, I don't really know how to do that, and I've never really tried to do that. And the second part, do I get treated differently? To be honest, I've never really been part of I very rarely encounter other journalists. I mean, I've never worked in an office. When I'm at games, I've no go out of my way to talk to other journalists, to be honest. So I don't know. I maybe that I'm thought of differently compared to proper journalists, but I don't know. I don't mean this to sound really arrogant, but that was the idea. You know, I was trying to do a different type of journalism. So if I'm treated differently from traditional journalists, then that's entirely logical.
Final question goes to Paul Morris. I have no idea about the background of this one, but are you still friends with Owen Coyle?
The story for this is, I mean, this is going back really long. This is about a decade ago. It was the first time when there was publicly available statistics on Premier League games in terms of possession, like really basic things like pass completion rate and possession. And Owen Coyle's Bolton were getting a lot of praise for their good football, and Owen Coyle was being linked with like the Arsenal job on the basis he played really good football. And I basically just knocked together some graphs showing that Bolton were doing certain things well, but they were winning headers, they were playing long balls, they were playing crosses. And it was just a really basic statistical article that showed they weren't really doing that kind of thing. And then Coyle was doing an interview for, I think, 442 magazine, and these figures were, or this article was put to him, and he was very dismissive of me and referred to me as zone or whatever, which really made me laugh, because if you know the first word is zonal, there's only one other word that follows in football, isn't it, really? So I felt it's a funny one, because I mean, I'd no problem with Owen Coyle, and you know, in later years when he's lost jobs, people have been like, messaged me on Twitter and said, oh, you were right. But never said he was doing a bad job. I just, you know, it was a really, really early example of where we had stats to show that what people had seen on 5-minute Match of the Day highlights was not really the reality. And of course, yeah, you look back on that article now and it's literally just possession share and pass completion rates, which no one really uses these days. But it is, it was quite funny at the time, especially, you know, it was probably one of the first times that probably an article I'd done had been put to a Premier League manager, maybe one of the only times. So it was funny at the time, certainly.
Yeah. Michael Cox, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much to Michael, and thanks to you as ever for listening to Behind the Lines and supporting the 42 as a whole. A reminder, you can get in touch with us, email behindthelines@the42.ie. You can tweet me, I'm @gcooney93, or you can join the WhatsApp group. The details of how to do that are in the episode description of this podcast. It's in that group, by the way, where you can submit questions for our future guests. We will be back next week with another great guest on Behind the Lines. But until then, take it easy.